Ready?
Yes, sir.
Please proceed.
May it please the court, Justice Berger, Justice Jacobs, Justice Ridgely, John Malik on behalf of Appellant Larry Marvel. This is an appeal from the Superior Court in Newcastle County from a criminal conviction to the Delaware Supreme Court, and it involves three issues. The facts of the case involve a situation where Mr. Marvel, an inmate who was at the very tail end of a 17-year prison sentence for a 1989 rape conviction, actually unlawful sexual intercourse second degree, was alleged to have solicited a fellow inmate, a gentleman by the name of James Hollis, to assault the victim of the 1989 rape conviction. The evidence at trial was largely provided by the testimony of Mr. Hollis and a series of letters that were exchanged between the two. The individuals, Hollis and Marvel, had known each other from years of being in prison together, and Mr. Hollis, who was also scheduled to be released from prison, at the time he approached the authorities and commenced a level 4 sentence, went to officials of the Department of Corrections and advised that Mr. Marvel had allegedly approached him and asked him to assault the victim of the 89 rape by either shooting her or stabbing her in the spine. He entered into an agreement with the Delaware State Police and prison authorities, and he ultimately was rewarded with a reduction of his supervision level. During the course of trial, actually at the beginning of trial, the state had filed a motion, and that was a motion in limine seeking to admit evidence of the specific nature of Mr. Marvel's 1989 unlawful sexual intercourse second degree slash rape conviction. The defense filed an answer to the motion in limine and suggested that although the state believed that the 17-year prison sentence was a proper purpose under Delaware Rule of Evidence 404B to establish the motive of Mr. Marvel to want to have the victim of the 89 rape conviction assaulted, that the specific nature of the crime was unfairly prejudicial, and that the danger of the unfair prejudice of the specific nature of the rape-related offense was substantially outweighed by the danger of the unfair prejudice. There was a ruling that was made by Judge Babiarz, and in Judge Babiarz's ruling, he, in essence, indicated that motive was a proper purpose. And in ruling on the issue of whether the 1989 conviction for rape could come in, he had indicated that it was important for the jury to understand the specific nature of the conviction, to understand the emotion in the case. And then the trial judge went on to explain that motive is a proper purpose, and the specific nature of the conviction as well as the 17-year sentence would come in to prove motive. And I submit that the ruling of the trial court was somewhat disjointed, because while certainly motive is a classic 404B proper purpose, the issue of emotion is not something that is traditionally a proper purpose, and I would submit it was not material to the case at all.
Well, when you say emotion is not a proper purpose, wasn't that the judge's way of explaining why this goes to motive? In other words, it's one thing to know that he had been imprisoned for 17 years. It's another thing to understand that this was a personal thing. This wasn't a matter of emotion to the defendant, and that would explain why 17 years later he's interested in getting some revenge.
Well, I believe that that's what the judge was attempting to do, but I think the flaw in the judicial reasoning in the lower court was that the key here was the defendant had lost 17 years of his life, and he had made statements in the letters between Hollis and Marvel that Hollis displayed these letters suggesting that he had lost the time with his son. He couldn't get this back, and he wanted the victim to pay and suffer for the 17 years that he suffered. It wasn't so much that I've been convicted of rape and I am angry because I've been convicted of rape. It was I was angry because I spent 17 years in prison. And I submit that when the...
But it was for a rape I did not commit, quote unquote, right?
He had always alleged he did not commit the rape, Your Honor, correct. But
way you would have wanted the trial to have played out, it would have been a felony I did not commit.
And yes.
Without any other explanation.
I thought it would be appropriate to show the length of the prison sentence for a felony level offense And in that respect, I had argued, and I think if it was a burglary, if it was a robbery, if it was for not paying taxes, it's rather immaterial what led to the 17-year sentence, because that seemed to be the focus of the defendant's ire. And to bring in the specific nature, if we talk about robbery, burglary, tax evasion, sure, they're felony type of offenses, but when you put on the table the offense of rape, that is probably one of the most heinous crimes on the books, maybe even in some circumstances even more heinous than a murder. And there is a stigma that goes with that, and it's my position.
And wouldn't it all the more reason to be angry about being convicted for a rape that was not committed?
Well, I think when we go, Your Honor, into the – that's true. But when we go into the temporal remoteness issue as well, again, I think that the balance should tip more in favor of the length of the sentence, and the reason for the defendant being mad was because he spent the time in prison, not for what the underlying offense was. It's clearly prejudicial. It's presumed that it's prejudicial, but is it unfairly prejudicial? And my position was that given the time involved and given what I perceived was the proper motive purpose, the time in jail, that was unfairly prejudicial to have the specific nature come in, because then the jury hears, oh, he's convicted of a rape, and there's an additional stigma that shows that he's not just a criminal, he's a perverted criminal. He's even a worse type of criminal. And this case wasn't about rape. It was about criminal solicitation and attempted assault. That's where I submit that the unfair prejudice came in, Your Honor. The second issue that I raised on appeal, Your Honor, is a 609 subsection B issue under the Delaware Rules of Evidence. And in the course of trial, Mr. Marvel testified. He took the stand, and he gave a long explanation as to why and how, well, actually, as to how he was attempting to challenge his 1989 rape conviction through direct appeal and through various post-conviction avenues. And in the midst of actually, there was a break, and we started up trial the morning of the next day. I was defense counsel at trial, and I segued into a question, and I used the term, in your efforts to clear your name, how did it come about that you selected James Hollis to be the one who was going to attempt to locate the victim of the 89 rape so you could obtain an affidavit or statement from her where she would recant her testimony? His testimony was that's what he sought to do, find the victim, because this was a fabrication. If she could recant her testimony, his name could be, I'm using it here again, he would be able to have the conviction overturned. Now, he never testified in any of the words that came from his mouth that were uttered by him at trial that he was attempting to clear his name. He never indicated that he had a good name. He discussed the efforts that he had taken to have the conviction reversed. And the case law that seems to be out there that talks about opening the door all relates to an affirmative display or showing of one's good character. And I submit that that's markedly different than one explaining, well, I've challenged this conviction for 16 years. There could be many reasons, as I submitted to the trial court, for him to challenge that conviction, one being that if he had that conviction on the books, he would qualify as an habitual offender. And he was, in fact, sentenced as an habitual offender to a life sentence of imprisonment. In this case, even though if he was not an habitual offender, he would have been looking at a statutory maximum of 5 years. So there were a lot of reasons why he may have wanted to challenge that conviction, short of saying, I'm a good person, this is out of character for me. And I believe that there was actually a misinterpretation or a misapprehension of Mr. Marvel's testimony. Also in the course of trial, once his mother had made a statement that she thought he was trying to clear his name, but she didn't say he was a good person, that he never did anything wrong, thus opening the door. When the state moved to introduce evidence of three very old, they were in excess of 10 years old, prior felony convictions, namely a 1980 conviction for a 1980 conviction for unlawful imprisonment, a 1979 conviction for rape, and a 1972 conviction for grand larceny, they first argued that they wanted to introduce this evidence to impeach the defendant. And they suggested that it was just the 80 unlawful imprisonment and the 79 rape that were the offenses that they wished to proceed with for impeachment purposes. There was no claim by the state in its initial argument to the court, and this could be found at pages A-165 to 160 of the appendix. There was no claim that the state wanted to bring this evidence in because Mr. Marvel had opened the door by claiming he was attempting to clear his name. In the trial judge's ruling, the trial judge indicated that, well, your client had professed that he was attempting to clear his name. He never said that. Again, a reading of the transcript of Mr. Marvel's testimony will render the complete and absolute result that Mr. Marvel had never said that. Yet that was the basis for why the court ruled that these very old convictions that were, in essence, 26, 27, and 34 years old were permitted to come in and be utilized by the state for impeachment purposes. In connection with those offenses, there is an analysis that has to be done that's a step further than just the normal balancing test. And in this instance, the court has to determine whether these very temporally remote convictions should come in the interest of justice, and if they're going to permit the introduction of the temporally remote convictions in the interest of justice, their finding has to be supported by specific facts and circumstances that show that the introduction of this evidence substantially outweighs its prejudicial effect. The case law is pretty clear that there is a prejudicial effect that is presumed when temporally remote convictions are going to be entered, and the case law suggests that it should be a rare occasion when they are permitted to be entered into evidence, and that they should only be entered if the court conducts an analysis pointing to specific facts and circumstances. And the fact and circumstances to which the trial court pointed was that Mr. Marvel professed that he was challenging his convictions to clear his good name. He never said that, and I submit
that. But didn't you say that?
I used that, Your Honor, in a lead-up to a question. It wasn't the question, and I've bracketed that out in my brief. And I basically, the question I meant to ask him was, sometime it does not pay to be long-winded, you make inartful statements. I meant to ask Mr. Marvel, how did you come to select Mr. Hollis to be the one to attempt to locate Lee Vinegar to obtain this affidavit? And we started up, it was probably the first or second question that morning. I gave a little background. We left off yesterday talking about your efforts to have your convictions overturned, and that's when I used the term clear your name. In his answer, he talks about, I met Hollis at the prison. I met him in a program at the prison. We became familiar with each other, friendly with each other, and I knew he was getting out, so I approached him. He never said, yes, I was attempting to clear my name, or I utilized Mr. Hollis. I selected him because I felt he would be helpful in having me clear my name.
But the point is that he's giving an explanation of why he's getting in touch with Hollis.
Correct.
And he's saying, I've been trying to get this conviction overturned for the last 17 years. I've gone to lawyers. I've done this. I've done that. And a reasonable inference from that activity is that he was trying to clear his name, and it's such a reasonable inference that you actually use that phrase. So how is it that you can then argue that, well, there was no reason to counter his claim of trying to clear his name because, after all, he never said those words?
Well, again, that was my words. They weren't his words. It was a generalization. I think the term clearing...
But he never disavowed those words. He never said, no, counsel, it's not because I want to clear my name.
No,
of something else.
No, we didn't get into any of that because in preparing for this, we didn't want to open the door to any type of affirmative indication that he had a good character, a good reputation. The term, I think, clear your name.
But as this counsel, you used the term clear your name.
Yes.
He never disavowed it, and the overall impression was that his attempt to enlist Mr. Hollins to find the victim, was for that purpose.
Well,
or at least in aid of that purpose.
I'm sorry, did not hear you.
At least in aid of that purpose.
Well, my response, Your Honor, would be the term, again, clear your name, was used in a generic sense, and that was synonymous with having your conviction overturned. The court said clear your good name, and that was one of the reasons, the specific circumstances the court pointed to in permitting the remote convictions to come in. And my response, again, is saying clear your name as being synonymous with challenging your convictions. By saying that, I didn't suggest that he had a good character, that he was arrest-free, that he was a good person, that he didn't have any type of propensity to commit this offense. It was a synonymous term for one's constitutional right to continue to challenge one's convictions on a post-conviction basis. And
as is that how a juror is going to interpret the phrase "clear your name"? Doesn't the ordinary common uses of "clear your name" is once it's cleared, your name is cleared, which means you have no blemish on your record.
I suppose one could look at it that way, Your Honor, but I think that that's different than in some of the other cases, the case that Mr. Wallace had sent up, the McAllister case, where there were specific questions directed to the defendant about prior convictions. We didn't go in that direction, and it was an inartful comment that I made that led to this. If we look at the term, and if you want to interpret that statement as indicating to the jury that he was also vouching for his good character, I think that you have to look beyond just the context of my inartful use of that phrase, and you have to look at the entirety of his testimony, where he's not vouching to be a good person. He's not having character witnesses come in his behalf. He's just talking about his efforts on appeal and his post-conviction challenges. And I think that that's where there's a line of demarcation. That is not affirmative introduction of character evidence. It opens the door that permits or encourages the introduction of very, very remote convictions. I do note in the state's answering brief, in one section they indicate that the defendant unequivocally indicated that he unequivocally and unconditionally claimed that Mr. Marvel's post-trial efforts were attempts to clear his name. Again, I just would underscore the fact that the transcript does not reflect that he had ever said that. And in the state's statement of facts, there's no indication that he had ever said that as well. And so
your argument is, number one, the defendant never specifically testified that he was trying to clear his good name, and number two, any suggestion to that effect that resulted from the way you phrased your question should not be attributed to the defendant.
Correct. The questions are non-testimonial, and sometimes segues between topics or questions are made as transitional statements, but I would submit that they're not evidence, and there's the traditional jury instruction that what the lawyers say and what they argue is not evidence, and it appears that that inartful phrase that I used is what the state is in essence hanging its hat on to suggest that Mr. Marble said that he was going to clear his name. The last argument, very briefly, I'm running out of time, I would suggest to the court that I've set forth the rationale and some case law about that, and that it was simply that a statement that is non-hearsay if it is presented to show its effect on the hearer, and that was the purpose of seeking to admit the letter from Mr. Mason to Mr. Hollis, that he had learned of the fact that another inmate believed that Mr. Marvel had snitched, and that gave Mr. Hollis a reason to wish to retaliate against him and fabricate the claims. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Justice Boger, Justice Ridgely, Justice Jacobs, Paul Wallace for the state. I'd like to go to the second argument first, because I believe that to say only the isolated statement in Mr. Mallett's questioning about clearing the name and not looking at the entirety of what Larry Marvel's defense testimony was really intends to isolate us and say, please don't hold against my client what I said. First and foremost, when an attorney asks a question and the witness then affirms that question or affirms the factual facts set forth in that question, certainly it can be considered testimony by the witness. Did you go to the store today? Yes. That would be certainly viewed as you, in fact, testified you went to the store. But look at what Larry Marvel's entire defense is. The entirety of his testimony is such that he wants to pit everything he says in his letters, every action he takes towards Mr. Hollis, including paying Mr. Hollis's sister money on Mr. Hollis's behalf, as simply an attempt to overturn his conviction, to quote, clear his name, the entirety of that. Pitting against it, Hollis's version of what happened, or Hollis's testimony about what happened, and that is, this is about harming the person who put him in jail for 17 years for a rape conviction. I suggested to the court that McAllister may be helpful earlier this week. When I reviewed this, I was not the trial attorney. I didn't write the briefs. I had agreed to do the argument on behalf of Ms. Medford. Because when I read it, it struck me that McAllister was very helpful. What was clear from Judge Babiarz's ruling is that he was not making merely a 609B ruling, but he was making a 607 straight impeachment ruling. If you untangle what Judge Babiarz talks about when he says opening the door, obviously you don't open the door necessarily to 609 unless you ask about specific convictions, is the fact that Marvel is saying, I'm trying to clear my name, whether he's merely affirming his counsel's own wording or whether it's through the totality of his testimony trying to cast in some different light the letters he wrote, the money he spent, and his other communications with James Hollis. And what Judge Babiarz is saying, when you say that, you've really opened the door to the fact that you don't have a clear name to begin with. If this was to go away, you wouldn't. And that that this is something different. This is going after the very victim in a very personal crime and making a very personal allegation when you make an allegation of rape that puts you in jail for 17 years. So really, it's much like McAllister. In McAllister, the attorney miscast in a way, probably asked some inartful questions if you look at the transcript section, and led McAllister to really give testimony that wasn't wholly factually accurate. And therefore, under 607, even though 404B would have otherwise kept those matters out, the fact that he'd been arrested on prior occasions, when you looked at 607, it's a straight impeachment question. There's also a second part to it. And that is, under 609B, whether independently they would have been, admissible. And I say independently because 609B talks about the fact that people have convictions and they say something about their credibility to begin with. That's what 609 is about. And whether or not certain times, even old convictions, may be used in that purpose. So the specific facts that the appellant wishes to say would have to be found to make this admissible, he would say it would have to be that Larry Marvel specifically said he was trying to clear his name. That's not what the specific facts and circumstances of the case mean by 609B. What specific facts and circumstances mean are the actual litigation that's ongoing at the time. The facts and circumstances that make that credibility question more important and that make conviction of prior crimes perhaps more telling in trying to assess credibility for the jury.
So you would have us depart from the rationale of the trial judge in admitting this evidence?
I suggest respectfully that
in order to sustain the ruling.
I suggest, Justice Jacobs, that you don't have to, because I believe that when Judge Babiarz was saying opening the door, he was really making that 607 type ruling, and certainly this court on prior occasions, in fact, as late as Monday, in the case of Ortiz versus State that I just saw on the website, has found that sometimes when the trial judges don't articulate the proper rationale for their decision, this court can still affirm on a basis that's different. But really, I believe that Judge Babiarz articulated both bases. The opening the door was really talking about the 607, and then when he looks at the convictions themselves, I don't know that he termed it as well as he did. He might have wanted to from the bench, but look at what's going on in this trial. We have a pitched credibility battle between James Hollis and Larry Marvel. This jury must know who to believe, and it's a little different than when they're both talking about something in the past. They're both talking about documents that are in front of the jury, and what Larry Marvel says, this is what I meant by those. James Hollis says, no, this is what was meant by those. They have to make that credibility determination. So the facts and circumstances of this case are such that credibility of each of these two witnesses is incredibly important. And let's face it, they didn't hold back in trying to impeach James Hollis. They spent pages just on one letter he wrote 13 pages of transcript. They mentioned every conviction he had. The jury has to be able to determine who to believe in this question. And so for the 609B analysis in this particular case, the facts and circumstances are such that when you have this crucial of a credibility determination, one on each side, facts in the middle, papers in the middle, what do they mean, that this is the type of case that under 609B, that in fact these types of convictions can be admissible. I believe Judge Madras was saying that.
Am I understanding your argument correctly in the sense that if I do understand you, you're saying this could not be harmless error, so that if it was error, it was not harmless because it was a he said kind of case, and a credibility determination was pretty much what won it for you. So if this information shouldn't have gotten in front of the jury, it could have affected the result?
I suggest that it I don't know that I would go that far, Justice Berger, and the reason is this. Certainly, it's not simply this evidence which cast Larry Marvel in such a light that this jury just didn't believe him and would have held him guilty of anything. If that were so, he would have been convicted of all charges. Certainly, this jury had no problem listening to the instructions, and in fact, the jury was instructed in this case on the 609 evidence in the jury instructions about the fact that witnesses had prior convictions and how they should use that. So I suggest that there may that it could possibly be harmless error, mainly because you see that in fact they were able to sort out the credibility questions and the use of the evidence appropriately. Secondly, there's no doubt that there was really so much information about both of these two people and their lack of probably being the person that you want living next door to you. One man is in jail for 17 years for a sex crime. The other one has been in and out of jail. They is a tobacco smuggler in jail and things like that. That I suggest that it would not be the turning point on Larry Marvel's credibility, certainly, but it's one thing that the jury could consider. And I suggest they must have considered it correctly. They weren't so overwhelmed by this particular fact or this particular type of evidence that they simply threw it out and said, you know what, I don't care what Larry Marvel says. He was out to hurt that victim, and you know, we're finding him guilty of everything. In fact, they found him not guilty of the most serious of the charges and guilty of only the other two charges. So I would suggest that you can't wholly throw out a harmless error analysis in this particular case under these particular circumstances. And I believe that there's facts in the record that would permit that. My argument really is that there was no error.
I understand.
Under Rule 607 and Rule 609. As to the 404B argument, I don't know that I could make it any better than Justice Ridgely did, so I probably won't try. But the bottom line was this. The judge did a proper Getz analysis. The judge gave the limiting instruction. And the judge permitted this evidence for the very reasons that actually Justice Berger and Justice Ridgely both mentioned in the questioning of Mr. Malik, and that is, this is a different type of crime. If the jury just understands that this man was in 17 years and this lady is related to it in some way, that might mean one thing to them. But when they understand the interpersonal nature of a rape crime and the fact that Larry Marvel is going to have to live with a rape conviction because of her, one that he claims that was wrongful and things like that, that may get to the basis of the hatred. Why in the world would somebody harbor that type of hatred for 17 years such that they may want to cripple someone, put them in a wheelchair? Well, a rape, what he believed to be an improper rape conviction based on her, may understand that, may make that more understandable than if they simply say, well, he was in for some reason and she had something to do with it. They had to understand the context of the relationship and understand the motive that he would have behind that. I suggest Judge Babiarz did the proper analysis, gave the proper instructions, and there was no error there. As to argument number three, relating to Bruce Mason's letters and whether they were properly excluded, here I'd suggest there probably could be a harmless error analysis if there was any error at all. I suggest there wasn't error. These were hearsay, plain hearsay. They were letters written after James Hollis ever even went to the police. So it's hard to believe that he had those in his mind when he decided to go forward. And
but obviously before happened. He testified.
They were before he testified. And that's where the question ends up being, and that's why I would suggest that if there's any error at all, it's got to be harmless. If you look, Your Honor, to pages appendix A75 through 78, the cross-examination of James Hollis, he's given his own letter. Interestingly, that wasn't included in the appendix by the defense. His own letter to Bruce Mason, in which he says, yeah, I think he's a snitch. He's going to get his, F him. He'll get his. They always do. He's asked by Mr. Malik, you thought he was a snitch? And James Hollis says, yeah, I thought he was a snitch. How in the world can two letters from some third party who's not testifying, who you don't get to cross-examine, be any more telling than his own written words and his sworn testimony that we're going to the same thing? Those are his words written. It's his testimony out of his own mouth that he would have had this, if they were trying to build this vindictive motive behind making up this story. So I would suggest when you look to Defense Exhibit 1, the letter that Hollis that was put in evidence of Hollis to Mason, where he is saying that, when you look at the testimony, and by the way, 13 pages of cross-examination on that very letter and whether or not they thought, whether James Hollis thought Larry Marvel was a snitch and where he admits it, it's not as if you needed Bruce Mason's letters in some way to discern whether that was true. He admits it. If it's error at all, it's got to be harmless. He had full cross-examination of James Hollis on that issue. He had better materials to cross-examine him than Bruce Mason's letters, and they were properly, I suggest, excluded under these circumstances. I have no other matters for the court. If there are any further questions, thank you.
Thank you.
Very, very briefly, three points. The first point was if the appendix is looked at, the record is looked at A151, 152, where my question was actually asked. My question to Mr. Marvel was, how did it come up that Mr. Hollis was going to assist you in any way with respect to the legal work that you were doing? Before that, there was the paragraph where I had talked about a renewed interest in clearing your name. And I would submit that, again, clearing the name and legal work were, in essence, synonymous, his continuing efforts, and was not an affirmative indication that he was attempting to bolster his credibility in any way. Secondly, with respect to Judge Babiar's ruling, the ruling was absolutely and exclusively made on the basis of 609 subsection B. That standard that's set forth in the Delaware Rules of Evidence is the exact wording that was utilized by Judge Babiar in his ruling, and there was no reference to 607 or any other permissible areas of impeachment. And I would submit that this was not a 607 type of conviction that could be utilized for impeachment. Certainly Mr. Marvel can be impeached, but once again, the case law that has been cited in the appellant's opening brief that the state does not address in any way, many federal cases show that in instances where there are extremely temporally remote convictions and they're utilized for impeachment purposes, they can be unduly prejudicial. And particularly the one case, the Ben Simon case, indicates that that's particularly true when there's a misapprehension as to the defendant's intent to it, rather his intent or efforts to try to suggest that he had a good character. So I would refer the court to those cases that were cited as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement and take a brief recess.